Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is September 11th, 2014. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Two upcoming events. I'm having lunch with subscribers, Lunch with Catherine in Albuquerque, on Wednesday, September 24th. If you're in the area, I hope you join us. Just sign up at the blog. And we'll be mailing invitations on Tuesday of next week for a November 8th event. That's a Saturday in Menlo Park, south of San Francisco. If you're interested but have not yet, let us know. Just email customer service and we'll make sure you're on the invitation list. That's going to be just subscribers invited, as well as private members of Joseph Farrell's website and some private clients and members of John Rappaport. So it will not be public. It will be private invitation only. Our theme tonight is Alibaba Says Open Sesame. As you know, I think the Alibaba IPO is going to be a bell that rings and shifts a lot of thinking about what's going on in the world, particularly in the United States, because we tend to be somewhat isolated here. We still don't. It's not like when you sit in Hong Kong and you read the news from all over the world. We tend to be much more domestic focused. Alibaba's on the roadshow and is getting ready to proceed with a IPO, $24 billion. It's going to be the largest IPO to date ever in the world. It's valuing the company at $155 billion. That puts it approximately the size of Amazon and about twice the size of eBay. The second largest IPO, or the largest to date until Alibaba's IPO goes forward, was the Agricultural Bank of China at $22 billion, the recent Facebook one was $16 billion. Remember, as I said last week, Alibaba has 276 active members as of June 30. That's larger than the adult population in the United States. China has 600 million internet users, and it's growing fast, particularly with smartphones. I put up a speech that Jack Ma did with Charlie Rose, an interview he did with Charlie Rose, as well as a link to a speech he did several years ago at Stanford. And I thought they're worth your time. I can't tell you that the stock is necessarily going to be a good investment. There are a lot of issues. And of course, IPOs, you can always end up coming out high and going much lower afterwards. It's remarkable if you go look at the list of IPOs, the differential in prices within a year of where they came to market. So beware and be careful. But I do think that the vision that Ma is presenting is a very different picture of the world than U.S. leadership presents. It's much more value-based. What he says is shareholders come third, customers come first, employees come second. And the reason employees come before shareholders is when times get tough, it's your employees who stick around and fight to keep you together, and the shareholders run off at the first sign of trouble, and he's right. The second thing he says is entrepreneurship is a pathway to create successful people and family income that helps families be successful, and that his dream is to help create jobs and help create small business, and to do so in a way that addresses and solves the problems that we face, including environmental. China's facing very serious environmental problems and pollution. This is music to the ear of leadership in the BRIC nations in China. If you're the Chinese leadership, your number one problem is creating jobs and, in fact, growing exports in the face of the U.S.-China rebalancing. So Ma's efforts and companies like Alibaba align with what you need. And it should be in line with the other BRIC political leaders. They need an entrepreneurship engine. They need small business. They need to grow up new businesses. To the U.S., this model is very decentralized and pro-small business, and it conflicts with the model here to date. Ma very rightly points out Alibaba could never have happened in the United States because the United States has been about aggregating and squeezing mainstream's revenues and income into corporations and corporate franchises. Now, what's interesting is the new model just underway that I'll be talking about later in the Soleri Report. Young people are being encouraged to start new businesses on a digital platform that fit nicely. So it's going to be interesting to see as the U.S. starts promoting young people doing startups and as crowdfunding goes forward, how that's going to fit with G7's policies to date, we see the SEC announcing that they're going to make crowdfunding regulations a priority this year. Just in a recent announcement from the CFTC that they're aligning their one of their holds on the crowdfunding regulations. More on that I'll post on the blog tomorrow or Monday. So, but historically, we've seen in the Western world, we've seen a giant sucking sound of the central systems trying to harvest every dime of equity and debt capital and flatten Main Street in the process. So it's going to be interesting to see if they're ready to reseed small business with a new generation, as long as they're operating on a digital platform, which clearly the NSA and their contractors firmly control. But as Alibaba, as this IPO sort of rings the bell, it's going to signal a very different decentralized model coming westward, and it's going to be interesting to see how the West reacts. Certainly one of the reactions is that as the global online market grows bigger than the US and the EU market combined, it's accelerating the pressure for closer European and US ties for the European-US deal transatlantic agreement, because they're facing the combined growth of economic power in the Asian markets, and it's the logical strategic move. Money and markets, there are more signs everywhere of deflation. We continue in a period of what I would say is consolidation and pruning, and events are full of double binds. You're watching two dynamics. One is war versus quantitative easing. Sanctions kill the economy, and then you pump up the economy that you're killing with more rich monetary supply and quantitative easing. Of course, what it does is it radically changes in winners and losers than from what would happen if you were using a market economy. And the Russia-Ukraine situation is a very depressing example of this. We see a real G7 and particularly US-UK decision to bust Russia literally back to a rather isolated, balkanized, deindustrial non-threat. You know, Russia long-term is a threat. It leaves US and Europe to grow closer and continue to lead in the face of the Asian growth. But what you're seeing is you're seeing the empire run around the world and in Middle East, Africa, Russia, and Eastern Europe. The way they're competing is by basically creating chaos and busting places. And they're shutting down the economy in many places. So it's not a pretty picture. The other way you're seeing this double bind is interest rates versus financial repression. If we had a free market, then interest rates would rise and it would clear the market. It would throw a lot of the bad behavior out. Instead, what you've got is you've just got oodles of government central bank credit. And what that does is that creates all sorts of bubbles. And so what you do is you repress with lots of rules. We saw Janet Yellen in her interview with Christine Lagarde saying she preferred loose monetary policy and more financial repression. It's a political way to clear markets, and it's not my favorite way whatsoever. An excellent Deutsche Bank bond study out, only available to clients, describing, but you can see summaries of it up on the internet, describing the conflicting signals in the bond and stock market and saying, how can the interest rates remain this low and the stock market be this strong? It's a very big question mark when you look at the debt overhang. So as we come into the fall, we're out of Labor Day. Let's take a look at what the markets look like. The U.S. dollar is at its year, you know, it's high for the year. It's up, up and away, trading above 84 and looking very strong, looking like it could potentially go much higher. U.S. equity markets are a critical point. Big question, are we finally going to get a long overdue correction or not? We're way overdue for a 10 or 20% correction. And a 10 or 20% correction is perfectly natural in a long-term bull market, which clearly we still remain in. The S&P dipped down below the 2000 mark this week. It's still up approximately 8% for the year. The emerging markets backed off this week. They're now up about 5% for the year. The long treasuries have been the star performer. Who can believe it? Who would have expected it? They're up about 12% for the year. Gold's falling back, looks very weak. It's only up about 2.5% for the year. And it looks like it could go much further down. In fact, one of the things you need to know is that You know, now's the time to make sure that what you're holding is your core, because an investment position could lose a lot of value right now. And you want to make sure that you're only going to, I don't think we found a bottom, and you want to make sure that you're prepared to ride down to the bottom, because we could see this drop more. The charts look very weak. Housing market is also weak. It's very much a local thing. So in the areas of the country where reinvestment is strong, it's doing much better than others. So it's not uniform whatsoever. All the commodities look weak. It's not just precious metals, clearly signifying deflation. Oil was up today, but it's been coming down and sharply cutting into Mr. Putin's revenues. Probably not a coincidence. Between the drought, weather problems, and the drop in agricultural commodity prices, it looks like farmers are headed into a very disappointing time at harvest time. Given the importance of the harvest to the economy, this is really going to compound the slow growth. Say prayers for the farmers in California. Latest announcement, the Sonoma and Napa wine country wineries lost over $50 million as a result of the earthquake several weeks ago. That news just out in the Wall Street Journal this week. The one sector that looks strong is, don't be surprised, defense stocks, whether the Islamic State, you wonder who's financing them, Russia, sovereignty in the South China Sea. It looks like there's plenty of economic interest promoting and profiting from weapon sales. As you know, I have deep suspicions about who's really financing ISIS and where some of Putin's strength is coming from. Big story this week is the battle for the net. We had it up on the blog. Check out our post on that if you don't know what it is. It's the ultimate in the pro-centralization control attempts. The FTC is moving to what some people call digital toll booths. Killing net neutrality is a political method whereby the dying extend their life. That's the cable companies, by killing that which is birthing and growing. And, you know, this is the danger of having big government in business. Everybody wants a monopoly, and the way to get it is to go to Washington and get them to engineer it. I think one of the things that is essential is it's very important to let state and local government compete openly and bust any private sector monopoly, because this is something that the accessibility and the cost of the internet should be much lower than they are. Tim Wu is the law professor who wrote the wonderful book Master Switch about the history of information technology. I have a review of it up on the blog, and I recommend it to you. He's the man who coined the term net neutrality, and he just finished losing the lieutenant governor race in New York, but got 40% of the vote, which is a remarkable performance, and it really puts him on the map as somebody to be considered for running for public office in the future. He was the running mate for Governor Zephyr Teachout, a Fordham law professor, another law professor. She also scored remarkably well in the Democratic primary. And I paid a lot of attention to that race for a couple reasons. But one, there's a clear message in their success in the primary, and you're seeing it all across the country, not just the loss by Cantor, but all sorts of races in Europe. And you're getting a clear message, and it's a very positive one, from the electorate, which is, you know, we are really sick of same old, same old. So what voters want is something fresh, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that message winds back into the leadership of the different parties. There's a piece I put up on the blog. It was an editorial from Bloomberg, which is worth noting, or an editorial-like comment. It's called Toxic Stew of New Technology and Old Hatreds and World Crisis. Let me just read you the quote from it. When you look at the world today, there are whole countries where there's 60% of the population under the age of 30, 50% under the age of 21, and 40% under the age of 18, Secretary of State John Kerry said at the State Department in Washington on September 3rd. We know that all of these young people in today's interconnected globalized world, with the media that's available to them, just look at the numbers in sub-Sahara Africa of young people walking around with smartphones. They don't have a job, they don't have an education, but they're connected, Kerry said. Connectedness without opportunity can be destabilizing. No kidding. One of the things that is happening, and I said to one of my partners earlier this week, you know, there would be times when the leadership would get together. They'd get together at the Bohemian Grove, or they'd get together at a variety of different sort of meeting places, and a decision would be made, and then suddenly some planning would be done, and all of a sudden you would see the same spin rolling out from many different institutions in the media, in government, in the financial sector, and you're seeing that now. And let's call that the millennial generation is being wooed. It's like somebody blew a whistle. You're seeing article after article about the sort of financial condition and future of millennial and young people. You're seeing all sorts of new financial planning, brokerage, and money management websites targeting the millennial generation. I've signed up for a whole bunch of them and are getting quite an education, sort of seeing what they're up to. The traditional brokerage firms are beating the drums and telling all their brokers and investment advisors to learn how to target and communicate with millennials. Shark Tank is announcing announced Shark Week. They're going to have a Shark Week on Shark Tank on every night with the best oldies for a week. The SEC has announced they're moving forward with crowdfunding regulations this year. My guess is they'll come out with preliminary and take comments and then come out with final. We'll see what happens. And now we have the CFTC just aligning and dropping one of their holds on one of the Job Act provisions. More on that on the blog. Part of this is you're also seeing single Americans now compromise more than half the U.S. population, and that's in part because of the millennials. So this is quite a production, and it's far from over. The surveys of millennials actually show that they're remarkably smart about finance. They don't trust credit card companies. They know that debt is dangerous. You know, student loan debt is a real problem. They don't trust the big banks. And if you look at a lot of the new pitches, it's all designed to say to them a whole lot of great stuff about, you know, saving and being responsible and prudent, but it's designed to route them all into the same systems. Oh, you can trust the digital systems. Give us all your data. It's really frightening. You can trust the financial system. Don't worry about identity theft. It's not a problem. It's very much don't worry and be happy. The reality is the millennials are much smarter than that. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how all of us can make the financial system much more understandable and much more accessible, and but help people understand, yes, how the Madoffs and the MF Globals happened and how to avoid them. One guy who has not figured it out, I put it up on the blog, but it was really because I wanted to address it. A professor from Boston, Lawrence Kotlikoff, did an interview with Greg Hunter about the SIP, Securities Insurance Protection Corporation, SIPC, and got it really, we call it SIPC, got it really wrong. He couldn't differentiate between Madoff and Stanford and what had happened in their cases and the average brokerage relationship. And it just goes to show you, because this is one well-educated, smart guy, it just goes to show you that navigating this system and understanding what's dangerous and what's not, where the risks are, is pretty tricky. And the problem is when you see the kind of systemic fraud we've dealt with, it's very hard to understand what you can trust and what you can't. So I sympathize, but although I have lots of criticisms, or I could come up with lots of criticisms of the financial system, Kotlikoff really goes overboard. New Jersey and Brazil's ratings got dropped, and it was, in a way, it's a very big uh-oh for me, because if you look at what's happening in New Jersey and the history of the pressure that the federal government has brought on the rating agencies, not to mention their culpability in the housing bubble, I think what we're seeing is real. You know, it's almost like the rating agencies have become an extension of, you know, the Treasury sanction game. If you watch the details of the different sanctions being rolled out on Putin and his team, they're very very invasive, very ugly, very political. You know, it's very 1984. And to see the bond rating game get caught up in that, you have to be careful. And that's why throughout the financial system, when I look at ratings, I'm very careful to try and understand when they are reliable and when I just need to do my own independent assessment. More often than not, it's looking like we're going to have to do our own independent assessments. Speaking of ratings, more challenges in the municipal area. The banking regulators, both Fed, FDIC, and OCC, came out with new rules as to what banks could buy. It having to be liquid, it was fine for them to buy stocks and corporate bonds, but municipals were deemed not to be liquid. Now, this is a real slap in the face. It's basically taking yet another major step to lowering the cost of capital for corporations vis-a-vis sovereign entities, or certainly state and local government. And it's all part of the move out of governments to corporations that we've been talking about for ages on the Salieri Report. But the pushback from state and local officials in an election year has been extraordinary and loud. And I think the regulators are going to have to backtrack on that. But don't be surprised if, you know, they keep coming on those issues. Another rating matter, Yelp got court support to say that they could continue to manipulate their business ratings in exchange for money. Yelp is now doing everything it can to nominate itself for the most despicable internet company. But do me a favor, have nothing to do with Yelp. It's really, I don't know where they're getting their air cover from, but it's pretty formidable and it's a pretty despicable company. I put up the prayer that we put up every year for the anniversary of 9/11. I just want to note today is the anniversary of 9/11, and it's a time when we give thanks for many things, but one in particular is all the very brave people who've done extraordinary work to bring transparency to what happened on 9/11. So if you're interested, check out that prayer. It's at the top of the blog. Scotland has delivered a complete panic to the UK. They have a referendum today on whether or not they can split off and become independent. You see a whole ream of banks say they're headed out of Scotland and back to the UK if the Scots go along. So we'll see what happens. We should know the vote pretty soon. Up on the blog, NASA announced that it's building a submarine that can explore the seas, the oceans on other planets. We see an announcement this week. It's up as related reading in that blog post, that the Japanese companies see their future in space. And I said to one colleague, well, I guess they've decided the game is up on Earth. There are no more profits here. They're out to outer space. And I think, you know, Dr. Joseph Farrell and I have been telling you that, and I think that's, in fact, the case. Our hero this week is a guy named Phil LeBoon. The article was up in Life last week. He was getting married, had paid for the food and reception. The bride canceled, and rather than sit around in grief, he'd already paid for the reception hall. He sold tickets, had an event for charity, got the hall and the food paid for, and made money for the charity. And talk about turning a lemon into lemonade. So that's the kind of attitude we need these days. Couple of really good questions and ask Catherine. Let me give it to you. Catherine, I'm a young male who's just graduated from college. I've read a lot about the prevalence of BPAs and synthetic estrogens that seem to have a presence everywhere in modern life, from various plastics to meat products and other foods. I've observed other males my age appearing to acting feminine. Their physical appearance to me would suggest that these types of synthetic estrogens appear to be impacting them. For example, a lot of young people have very skinny arms and soft faces. Do you believe that these types of estrogens may be deliberately designed to influence behavior and appearance in males? There are historical statements made by people like Charles Darwin that would suggest that these methods were speculated about long ago. To this, I speculate that the application of technotronic weaponry like HARP may work in tandem with what I've mentioned to influence both the physiology and physicality of males. This may also be a factor that explains the sub-replacement fertility levels in the West. Do I understand the details of what they're doing? No. Do I think they're doing this kind of engineering? Yes. Are they doing this specific one? Probably. But things can always be more complex than that. But I do think that the policies regarding health on the broadest level are manipulated in these ways, unfortunately. And if you look at the history of what's and the evidence of what's going on with vaccines and autism, that's probably one of the clearest cases that sort of undergirds what I think your premise is. Hi, I'm a new subscriber from Canada. I found you via this blog. I enjoy your interviews and your sense of humor. I have an interview suggestion for you. Thanks for doing what you're doing. Okay, we're going to take a look. And again, thank you all for great interview suggestions. Please keep them coming. It seems to me that their control over humans, the powers that be, over what gets reported in the media, given their control in the media, the powers that be could make the problem of Watergate go away for Richard Nixon if they'd wanted to. With this in mind, do you think they decided they wanted to get him out of office? Absolutely. Yes, they could make Watergate go away. If anything, they created and fed it. And yes, they could have made it go away. And absolutely, yes, they wanted to get him out of the office. Let's go to the movies. It's very important to understand that the black budget and the drain in the system very much skims us nickels and one nickel and one dime at a time. And it's one of the reasons I chose a very charming little movie because our interview this week was on municipal issues. It's called Mayor Cupcake. And the protagonist, who's a baker who becomes the mayor of Bridgeville, her small town, reminds me very much of the woman who runs our operations. In fact, if I didn't know better, I would have thought they took a whole lot of material about her and gave it to somebody and said, here, go make a movie. And she, by accident, her kids nominate her for mayor, and the mayor, who's expected to win the election, dies, and she gets appointed mayor, and she proceeds to clean up the town. And you have a lot of local business guys basically running the town in a corrupt way, and they're making a lot of money. Now, she cleans it up. The reality is this story really doesn't completely fit with what's going on because, yes, the local boys are in on it, but they only get a small piece. In fact, a lot of the money is not staying local. It's getting skimmed off and going centrally. However, one of the reasons I wanted you to see this movie is if you're going to clean up America, then this is the kind of cleanup that's got to happen because it's very bottom up, it's very detailed, and it's one thing at a time on Main Street. And the waste in the economy is unbelievable. If you could turn Mayor Cupcake loose in every town in America, it's amazing. Not just the money you would save, you'd stop the waste, but a lot of what's stopping the economy, the biggest tax is what it does to people's spirits, their entrepreneurship, their ability to do things together, either civic activities or business. You know, it really destroys the trust, which is the whole basis of markets and an economy. And so you start to turn loose this kind of effort in a lot of places. It's amazing what could happen. So one of the things I noted in the blog post is that I live in a town with a mayor and a city council who I trust to watch every penny, and it's a very good feeling. I also live in a county with a sheriff that I have great confidence in, and it's also a great feeling, and I wish that I could believe that every one of you was enjoying the same kind of leadership. Our interview this week is with Joe Mizak, who is really the dean of municipal bond reporters. He's an editor at Bloomberg, and I've known Joe for years since I was on Wall Street. The municipal market is very important. First of all, it's $3.7 trillion. Those are big holdings in the retirement portfolios of America. But municipals is historically the way that places and infrastructure in the U.S. is financed. There is a lot going on in that market that's rarely covered. It's a very media quiet market. I dare say if you got the official statement for the bonds sold by the state and local entities whose jurisdiction you're in and in which you live and pay taxes or fees, you would find it absolutely fascinating reading. I really encourage you, whether it's your town, your county, your state, and the various sort of municipal corporations that issue bonds, I would really encourage you to go out and read all of their disclosure, because you'd find out enormously interesting things about the place you live. It's a very interesting interview. Joe has just published the half-year stat book, which is available. I link to it on the blog. And we go through a lot of the big issues in the municipal market. Of course, Joe was the guy when Meredith Whitney came out and said there was going to be real blood on the streets in the municipal market, like the mortgage market. It was Joe who said, no, she's wrong. And he was right. And one is there are a lot more tie-ins between the federal governments and the kind of money that can be backdoored into the state and local governments. It's a much more complex situation, and you have to know it well, which Whitney didn't and Joe did. So anyways, great interview with Joe Mizak. That's it for this week. Coming up next week, we're going to talk about the November event with John Rappaport and Dr. Joseph Farrell. It's called How to Live a Free and Inspired Life. The name of the event is How to Live a Free and Inspired Life and Help Others Do the Same Despite the Big Pink Breakaway Civilization in the Room. And then the following week, a great interview with Joe Klein-Sibahar. One of the most invaluable things you can do to live a really rich and rewarding life is to make friends with death. I'm a person who's dealt with death a lot in my life and contemplated my own death a lot. And it's amazing if you contemplate your death and then move back to where you are, but you live back from your death, you know, start with the end in mind. It's a very rewarding thing to do. And also being with and helping others that you love or care about, your friends and family, it's part of helping them with their transitions and death. It can also be an enormously rewarding thing. So it's being good at and understanding the process of death, to me, is a critical skill. And it's one that takes thought and education. And Joe is an attorney. She was chair of one of the biggest hospice in Iowa, and she has remarkable insight and remarkable tools to help you begin to do that. And then October 2nd, a great time. I'm going to be speaking to you from California. It's the third quarter wrap-up. So until next week with John and Joseph, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.